This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, we'll hear from some of the residents forced to flee their homes by early spring fires that are raging in New South Wales and Queensland. Stigma surrounds the cashless welfare debit card and the government wants to expand it. And the fight for leverage in Afghanistan after President Trump calls off talks with the Taliban. But what about the Afghan people? Welcome to PM. A major fire on Queensland's Sunshine Coast continues to burn out of control. More than 5,000 residents have been forced to leave their homes and seek shelter elsewhere as gusty winds continue to make the fire unpredictable. Last night, people from the community of Perigian Springs fled from their homes as the large fire approached. Today, the acting Queensland Premier said it was nothing short of a miracle that only one home was lost and several damaged. Rachel Mealy joins me now from the Incident Control Centre at Perigian Springs. Rachel, we've heard about the tinderbox conditions and the very strong winds. Pretty frightening for those in the path of the inferno.
That's right. Many people have told me their tales today of the frightening scenes that confronted them at around dinner time last night. People talked about the wall of fire that raced towards their homes. They spoke of the strong winds of up to 60 kilometres an hour that were fanning the flames and creating ember showers that streaked along suburban streets. And many said they grabbed what they could and ran.
We went outside just to check and we saw an amazing explosion of debris up in the air, and we thought, this is serious, we better get out. So we just grabbed a few things and away we went.
Not the kind of holiday you envisaged?
No, not quite.
Where have you travelled from?
We've travelled from Daylesford in Victoria.
So you know this fire
activity? Oh, yeah,
that's
right. We know that fire, yeah. And we really thought Queenslanders were rather relaxed about it. I went to tell the neighbour next door and he was quite relaxed and he said, oh, no, I'll just put the hose on the fence or whatever. And to a Victorian, you just leave. You just wouldn't worry.
So you must have been looking at that ember shower that was happening and getting very afraid.
Roberta.
Yeah, the ember showers were really amazing because I didn't really understand what an ember shower was until we were actually in one and driving through it, and it was just raining down on the car and everybody was just manic and driving as though I just didn't know how to drive anymore. It was just so scary being on the road. Mm. It was a shocking experience because it just happened so quickly. It just blew up and we just couldn't get out of there fast enough, really.
Red sky, that's all. We couldn't see much other than red sky.
What did you grab from your house?
That's the interesting thing. It's not till you run around with 10 minutes to leave your house that you go, do I want this, do I want that? And it's amazing what you don't want, what you don't need.
Have you seen it like this before?
Never. I've been here for 34 years.
You've never thought that your property could be under threat from a bushfire?
I think you can't live in Australia. It's like living in Australia and think you're not under threat by being bitten by a snake. It's always a threat in this country.
I watched it from when it started. It just moves so fast. And I actually went down the roundabout at Perigian near the shops and I saw it cross the road. Actually, the flames cross the road, not over the road, but actually cross. And the policemen scream, go, it's moving fast.
And where did you go to?
I came here. Yeah.
And you spent the night here? Did you manage to get some sleep?
No. It was cold. I've got a small car and there was music going on across the road in the hotel, so I decided to come down here and just talked all night and haven't stopped since. I'm going hoarse now.
There's just a few of the stories that were being told today around these communities around Perigian Beach. Now, the wind this afternoon is still very strong and gusty, although it has lost a bit of strength since last night. Today, fire authorities have staged a pretty concentrated attack on the fire front using water bombing aircraft, and that culminated late today with a large aerial tanker, a Boeing 737, which was flown from New South Wales, and that dropped 15,000 litres of water and fire retardant onto the flames. At this stage, residents in the affected communities have been told that they can't return to their homes while the fire still rages, and people have still just existing on really what they grabbed last night and left their homes. As you'll hear from this woman, she says she grabbed one of her precious dolls before she left her home.
What did the fire look like when you left? Did you see any of it as you were leaving?
Just that great orange glow on the southwestern horizon, which was in the direction of the Perugian Springs. Yeah, and I could just see this big glow, and it seemed to extend forever. That's when, I sort of thought, yes, let's get out of here.
What did you grab in those moments?
Oh, well, this might sound really foolish, but my sister is an original doll artist, and I nicked one of her dolls years ago. And she's so precious to me that when we were kids, Dad told us that a myth was a female moth. And so this is a doll sitting on a toadstool with raggedy wings, and she's called Miss Myth. The first thing I stuck in the car was that.
So she's safe.
She's safe, yeah.
One of the residents at Perugian Springs with Rachel Mealy, our reporter in that region as well. Well, authorities fear some of the fire's devastating parts of Queensland have been deliberately lit. The state's police commissioner has pleaded with parents to talk to their children about the consequences of lighting fires. And fire experts say that climate change means that fires, regardless of how they're started, are increasingly difficult to manage. Julia Holman reports.
As dozens of fires burn across Queensland, authorities are investigating if some of them were deliberately lit.
There are at least 8 fires in scope at the moment, and that number will increase.
Queensland's Police Commissioner Katrina Carroll has set up a task force to investigate suspicious blazes.
The consequences of some of these fires are dire. People can die. Buildings and residences are being destroyed.
She says police suspect some fires were lit by children.
Can I please ask parents to speak to their children? These are not usual conditions. They're actually quite dangerous. Some fires have just clearly gotten away from kids thinking they're having fun. There has been reckless and purposeful behaviour by others.
Dr. Janet Stanley is an arson expert and works with the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute with Melbourne University.
Arsonists are very hard to catch. We think about half of bushfires are malicious fires, deliberately lit.
She says arsonists fit into 3 main categories.
The biggest group that commit arson are youth, 13, even up to 24. Unfortunately, there's children under that age. And then the other group is older men. So there's these 3 sort of target groups that carry out this activity. Women do it, but not as often.
Dr. Stanley says many young arsonists don't realise how much damage they can cause. And she's warning the media not to sensationalise its bushfire coverage.
The media needs to be very careful of how they present these fires and perhaps report a bit more about the consequences of the fire, because we're all in a rush when they an excitement and visual displays when they occur, but it's not often so much about the tragedy and how lives are destroyed as a result of the fire.
Greg Mullins was the Chief of Fire and Rescue New South Wales. He retired in 2017 after nearly 50 years of service.
Very frustrating. And you can get very angry if you know that somebody has definitely lit the fire.
He says many wildfires are accidentally lit by landowners who use fire to manage their properties.
A warming climate, changes in weather patterns, it's reducing windows where people can safely burn.
Professor Leslie Hughes with Macquarie University and the Climate Council says bushfires used to happen gradually around Australia during the hotter months, but that's changing fast.
Increasingly, what we're seeing is simultaneous fires breaking out in multiple states. And whereas previously those states could share firefighting equipment and personnel, now we're looking at not being able to share them because they're needed simultaneously in multiple sites.
That's a concern shared by retired firefighter Greg Mullins, who's also a climate councillor.
I just think it's inevitable. It's going to happen where each state will be on their own on a very, very bad day or days.
He says it's becoming an international problem.
The bigger picture is that our fire season now overlaps with the US, Canada, and Southern Europe. We get all of our large firefighting aircraft, bar one, from the US. And August last year, we had major fires through New South Wales. We didn't have any large firefighting aircraft during those critical days.
Greg Mullins believes that governments need to invest in aerial water bombers and improve building standards in areas that are increasingly fire prone.
There's huge costs involved in this, and the volunteers need to be backed up. They're going to be exhausted by the end of summer.
Retired New South Wales Fire Chief Greg Mullins, Julia Holman, our reporter. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, a dog on the back of a ute. It's quintessentially Australian, but could it be on the way out in Victoria, where owners could be fined for not giving their four-legged friends sun protection? But could there be unintended consequences?
You know, they love jumping in the buggy and going with you on the farm, and, you know, they mightn't have the space. Like, for example, in a ute that's only got three seats. Yeah, I think it'd be a shame.
If you get a vaccine or immunotherapy for cancer or an organ transplant, you will be benefiting in part from the lifelong work of the Australian immunology pioneer, Emeritus Professor Jacques Miller. And today, Professor Miller has been awarded one of the highest international honours in medical research for his key work in immunology over decades. Professor Miller is a joint recipient with Professor Max Cooper of Emory University in the United States of the Lasker Award. It's a US award and widely considered a predictor of the Nobels. Professor Miller is from Melbourne's Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. I asked him first for his reaction to receiving such an honour.
I feel very honoured, very humbled too. I'm very pleased to have such a prestigious honour. Thank you.
The big breakthrough that you and your colleague made was about T and B cells in the human immune system. So for the uninitiated, for the non-medical amongst us, what are they?
They are white blood cells which fight off infection or anything that is foreign, like a foreign transplant. They come from, the T cells come from the thymus and the B cells come from the bone marrow. That's why they're called T and B. They're most important in fighting off infections.
What were the implications of discovering that there were these two different types of cells?
Well, the two types of cells talk to each other and they talk to other types of cells in the body. And in order to understand what goes on in many, many diseases, we have to know how T and B cells work and how they cross-talk with other cells in the body. So it leads us to understand inflammation, infections. It leads us to make better vaccines. It leads us to understand troubles with the gut when you have inflammatory bowel disease. It leads us to understand what's happening in allergies, what's happening in immunodeficiencies, in autoimmunity like multiple sclerosis, in even in pregnancy, when things go wrong in pregnancy, during eclampsia or preeclampsia, we understand now what's going wrong and we might be able to do something about it. And of course, in cancer.
This is truly revolutionary. When you think back about your career, are you struck by how important your work has been?
Well, in retrospect, yes. I didn't know at the time. But now it's blossomed out into a huge science. Immunology has exploded, so to speak.
Because we're talking about your work going back to 1961. I mean, what were you doing in 1961?
The first discovery was made in London in 1961, and that's the discovery of thymus function. Before me, they thought that the thymus was useless. So I found out that it makes T cells and it's a very important organ. And in 1966, at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne, I found that there are two types of lymphocytes, as I mentioned, T and B cells. Mm.
As you said, immunotherapy is this vastly growing area. What still can be done in the field? What do you think needs to be achieved next?
Well, If you're talking about cancer, only 20% of melanomas can be cured by T cells. A simple injection of T cells can kill the cancer cells. Why 20%? We need to find out what's happening in the other cancers. So what we have to find out is what are the different parts that cancer put up at different times. When we find out this, we'll know how to cure more cancers. So there's a lot to be done.
And do you think medical research in this country is in good shape, or does something need to change?
I think it's in very good shape from the point of view of the people who are doing research. I think Australia has done extremely well in the world scene, and we're a very small country compared, for example, to America, and we've done extremely well. But as you say, writing grants is a big burden on our people, and it's a pity that it's so difficult now to get money for research, but what else can we do?
Professor Miller is from Melbourne's Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. Trauma-informed schools. They are schools that aim above all else to create safe, supportive spaces for students who have faced hardship in their lives. But do they work? Well, Sutterdeen Primary School in Alice Springs has been a pioneer in the practice. Oliver Gordon has been visiting their classes.
3 years ago, primary school student Lily found being at school hard. LDT
on the mic. I used to get angry really quickly, really naughty.
But now she says she quite enjoys it.
I'm better now, yeah. I'm a student leader now.
Lily goes to Sutterdeen Primary School, and right now she's sitting in a positive learning centre, listening to the song she made. I want to feel alive, be brave, stay that way. She says rapping helps her to express herself.
You can just rap all your stuff out, like what you're feeling inside.
Lily created this song with Mr. Ash, who runs music classes which aim to build up a sense of identity and confidence. He's been working with Lily since she started rapping and says he's seen a change in her.
She talks about things. She's a great MC. She's got loads of confidence on the mic. And I really feel, yeah, Lily's one of those kids that makes me feel welcome in the school.
Mr. Ash and the Positive Learning Centre are all part of Sutterdeen Primary's trauma-informed approach to schooling, an approach that places students' safety and belonging at the centre of every element of school life. Sutterdeen Primary Principal Lizzie Verstappen says there's lots of buzz around trauma-informed practice, but at the end of the day, it's about creating safe spaces for kids to learn.
We look first at teaching our kids about social and emotional learning, so that's right across our school.
And you can see it. Plastered across the school's walls are posters with instructions on how to find a safe space, calm down, find peace and reduce negative feelings.
If they can understand their emotions and how their emotions work, and the reason why they might be feeling certain ways at certain times, then they have a better chance of regulating that.
Marina Dixon from the Australian Childhood Foundation says trauma-informed practice is being taken up across Australia, including all government primary schools in South Australia. She acknowledges there are some concerns about it.
One of the misconceptions about trauma-informed practice is that there is no discipline. I think the difference for us in thinking around a trauma-informed approach is how do you implement the boundaries and how do you implement those limits. And what we kind of say is, well, the relationship comes first. So we'll still say that behaviour is not okay, but what we then say is, but it's not that you as the child are not okay. We're still holding the relationship with you, but it's still not okay to do that thing. It is about reframing boundaries and how we respond when kids step outside those boundaries.
Back in the Positive Learning Centre at Sutterdeen, Lily says she's unsure if she wants to pursue a career in music. One thing she does know, though, is that school is now a happy place for her.
It's a supportive environment because there's a lot of kind people just to talk to.
Alice Springs Primary student Lily speaking with our reporter Oliver Gordon. A 12-year-old Aboriginal boy named Duane is nervously preparing to deliver a speech to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva tonight. He'll be imploring Australia to stop putting 10-year-olds in jail, something that is still legally possible in all states and territories, despite repeated recommendations to raise that age limit to 14. Duane is an Arrernte Garawa boy from Central Australia who himself was at risk at the age of 10 when he ran away from school, saved instead by family and community drawing him close. I spoke to Duane a little earlier as he was preparing for that speech. So, Duane, how are you feeling about speaking to this UN committee?
I'm feeling nervous.
Nervous. Why are you nervous?
This is the first time that I'm talking to something big.
And what is the message that you want to get across to this meeting?
I want my school to be run by Aboriginal people. I want the juvenile detention to stop crueling 10-year-old kids in jail.
And why is it bad that 10-year-old kids are being put in jail?
Because it trains them to go for the bigger jails.
If kids get in trouble at 10, what should happen to them? Who should be looking after them? Who should take care of it?
Family.
And what are you hoping will be the reaction in Australia when you give your speech?
Government change.
You want the government to change the policies?
Yes.
And would you like to read a little bit of your speech for me?
Okay. My name is Dua. I am 12 years old. I'm from Adana in Garwa country. I came here to speak with you because our government is not listening. Adults never listen to kids like me, but we have important things to say. There are some things I want to see change. I want my school to be run by Aboriginal people. I want adults to stop cruelling 10-year-old boys in jail. It is about our dreams, our hopes and our rights.
That's Duan. We've been asked to withhold his family name. He's 12 years old and he's in Geneva, no less, with his father and grandmother for support. Well, Shalina Musk is a senior lawyer from the Human Rights Law Centre. She's also there with Duan. She's a Larrakia woman with long experience in youth justice in the Northern Territory. I asked her why Australia should raise the age of criminal responsibility to 14.
Children as young as 10, 11, 12, they're going through substantial development, both mentally, emotionally and physically. They're not at an age of maturity where they are able to understand the consequences of their actions or really the long-term implications of being labelled a criminal. The parts of the brain's responsible for consequential thinking, thinking through the likely implications or effects of their conduct just are not formed and won't be for many, many years. Children this young coming into contact with the youth justice system are children who are often well known to the child protection system, who are victims, survivors of neglect, abuse and mistreatment. So they're children who carry with them a lot of trauma and substantial needs. So pushing them through the youth justice system this young only serves to further compound their trauma and disadvantage and does nothing to change the sorts of behaviours that we need to change. So we're asking for the age to be raised so that we're responding to these children outside of the justice system.
A number of governments have had reports and royal commissions, indeed, with recommendations on this very issue. Nothing has really shifted, although some governments, like the NT government, for example, say that they've got other programs, they've got outreach with parolees, there's new diversion programs planned. Are they moving in the right direction with those things?
Well, that's what they have said. We need to have in place a range of responses for children who present with risk early in their life. And I commend the NT government for doing this. But the reality is many of these children are known to the education system, are known to the health system and the child protection system. And from my experience as a youth lawyer working in the Northern Territory, these systems have failed these young children and the justice system has become almost a first protocol for responding to these kids in ways that are quite harmful and detrimental to their lives and their futures.
So when Duan gets up and speaks to the UN Human Rights Committee on this issue, one of the things he's also going to mention is wanting his school to be run by Aboriginal people. Is that part of the same story?
And it was a question that was actually asked yesterday of a committee member and a child rights expert is noting the low retention rates for Aboriginal children, particularly in later years and as the year progresses. Why is it that Aboriginal children are disengaging from school? This is the problem. There is no consistency across states and territory when it comes to youth justice regarding child protection and also the provision of educational services. So I think what we should be doing is ensuring that all of these services and systems are acting consistent with child rights. And that's what, you know, that's why we're here in Geneva, is Australia doesn't ensure that states and territories are acting consistent with these minimum standards and established child rights.
Shalina Musk with the Human Rights Law Centre, and good luck to 12-year-old Aboriginal boy Duan in Geneva tonight. A dog on the back of a ute is a sight that's synonymous with regional Australia, maybe even parts of the city. There are concerns, though, that that could soon change. Draft animal cruelty laws before Victoria's Parliament would see dog owners fined more than $400 for having a dog on the back of a ute without proper protections on a day above 28 degrees Celsius. But farmers say in its current form, the draft law could have unintended consequences. Henry Swartz has the story.
Guy Robertson's dog, Cyril, loves heading into work.
For many farmers, the dog's with them all day, so they interact more with their dog than they do other people. And you always know, for example, where I am based on where Cyril is.
But the Tasmanian pig farmer is concerned by proposed legislation in Victoria that would fine owners who leave dogs on the back of utes on a hot day without a protective surface underfoot, like plastic sheeting. Victoria would be one of the first with specific fines around heat and utes.
I think, like, what's the practicality for, like, dogs wanting to travel with you? I know that Cyril, once I've loaded the pigs onto the back of the ute, like, he'll wait by the ute all day because he knows that I'm going on a road trip and he gets to come with me. So they love going with the farmer, and it's the practical. If you've got two farms to put the dogs on the back of the ute, you know, they mightn't have the space. Like, for example, in a ute that's only got three seats, to have them in the front, and I'm not sure about seatbelts for dogs. That sounds interesting. So, yeah, I think it'd be a shame.
Working dogs are not only loved by farmers, but worth thousands of dollars. But the farmers say it's not always practical to have plastic or rubber sheeting on a ute tray, with often makeshift bean bags or shelters used instead. Victorian sheep farmer Scott Young says the draft laws should be more flexible.
A lot of farmers have got large acreages, and to get from one area to the other, you need to use a ute and have your dog in the back of the ute and travel along as long as they're secured safely. I think it's very necessary that we've got to have that. We work some pretty big days, and our dogs are essential to us. They're like two or three employees, so they're essential.
Leonard Valance from the Victorian Farmers Federation says farmers shouldn't be too concerned for now, saying the draft laws are aimed primarily at everyday pet owners.
Look, this sort of talk about police visiting farms and fining people for having a dog on the back of a ute's nonsense. And this will be, I mean, I live near Swan Hill and Mildura in northwest Victoria, and look, when there's a lot of station utes go into those towns, and the dogs are really well looked after on the back of the utes, and it's the recreational dog owner that's the issue, and they park the ute in the street and leave the dog chained up in the hot sun. They're the people that will be fined. The dogs are worth, you know, $10,000-$15,000 today, and a farmer's not going to risk the health of that animal.
Meanwhile, Guy Robertson and Cyril have a full day's work ahead of them.
You ready, Cyril? Go for a drive. Come on, boy.
Yeah, they love jumping in the buggy and going with you on the farm, and yeah, like, Cyril greets everybody that comes and visits the farm, and it's just part of the culture of living and working on a farm.
Guy Robertson and Cyril with our reporter Henry Swartz. I'm Linda Mottram, and that's PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review while you're there. See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. It's been 28 years since our last recession, and a lot of people are worried we're about to hit another one.
A lot of things are different now. The warning signs, the global economic climate, but plenty of others are exactly the same. So what was it like last time? And how could things play out differently now?
That's The Signal, every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.